Today we continue with the second program in our series on the Radio Cafe, Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each of these panels is intended to provide various cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They are produced and moderated by oral historian and author Jack Leffler. Today's panel features Rena Swensel from Santa Clara Pueblo, Lyle Belenqua from the Hopi Independent Nation, and Esteban Arellano, a sequero from Embudo, New Mexico. Today we continue with the second program in our series on the Radio Cafe, Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each of these panels is intended to provide various cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They are produced and moderated by oral historian and author Jack Leffler. Today's panel features Rena Swensel from Santa Clara Pueblo, Lyle Belenqua from the Hopi Independent Nation, and Esteban Arellano, a sequero from Embudo, New Mexico.
As Craig said, I've spent a fair amount of time over the last 50 years hanging out with people from indigenous cultures all over their own homelands. And one of the things that has always struck me, whether it was up in Nez Perce country up in Idaho or down with the Mayan Indians down in Chiapas, is that I have never met a traditional indigenous person who didn't regard homeland as sacred. Indigenous mind is that aspect of collective human consciousness that is shaped more by the flow of nature through homeland than by a list of facts about the nature of homeland. That to me is a really big distinction. And I feel that these folks who are going to be joining us this evening really have been shaped by the flow of nature through their homeland, and that is what inspires them in very large measure. And so I would like to ask you to help me welcome Rena Swensel, Lyle Belenqua, and Esteban Arellano. Here are our panelists for this evening.
Thank you.
Have an occasional pop and whistle here. Before we start our panel discussion this evening, each of the panelists will speak to you for a little bit about their perceptions. Now, our whole series is called Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed. And part of thinking like a watershed is seeing the bigger picture of which water is a part. And so with that, I would like to introduce my old and dear friend, Rena Swensel from the Santa Clara Pueblo.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you for coming out tonight. I wish I could see your faces. We're so much in the light here, I can't see your faces. But it's nice to be with you. I was driving in. I'm from Santa Clara Pueblo, live in Santa Clara, and drove in from Espanola this afternoon. And it's springtime in New Mexico. The wind was so harsh this afternoon as it was in Santa Clara. The dust was blowing. There was just, you know, dirt in the air, which is springtime in New Mexico. And as I was coming in, I was thinking about myself being in a car, driving to Albuquerque, which is the other end of the world for me right now. But thinking about what it must have been like to have lived in this land before one could be in a car, safe from that harsh blowing dust. You know, it's so easy to think that the wind is a nuisance. That is just something that we have to bear with for the time. But if you think about it, this is what has defined us in the Southwest. The wind and the all that blowing dust, a result of no water on the land. And the feeling that the people who lived here before us, before we all came here with our cars and cell phones, how all of that defined what they thought and the language that they spoke that we still speak today. It's really what makes us who we are in this place. I remember a time being out on the volcanoes out here on the west side, and there in the planning sessions for trails, there was some talk about, well, how do we give people more shade, and how do we give them water out here? I was amazed because, no, this is what this land is. This is an arid place. This is what we live with. How does one become one with rather than trying to fix it all the time? Is my 8 minutes up?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Rima. Well, Rina has a wisdom that is rare in this world. We're going to turn to our friend Lyle Balenqua, who just this past Sunday took out from having run part of the San Juan River. And Lyle has a whole wonderful perspective that comes from his Hopi tradition that we're going to ask him to share some of this evening. Lyle Balenqua.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of this panel, and thank you all for showing up this evening. I feel very privileged to be a part of what is going on here. I've heard the names on this panel for many, many years, and wanting to know more about who these people are and the knowledge that they have within themselves. I say that because I'm all of 38 years old right now, and so I feel very much like I'm in the listening stage rather than one who has any sort of expert knowledge to expound to people. So a couple of years ago when Jack approached me, having met him through some other work, maybe a quick introduction is better appropriate. I come from the village of Balcovi on Third Mesa. If any of you are familiar with the Hopi Reservation, that's where I drove in this morning. I spent part of my youth there, but also partly growing up in Flagstaff, Arizona. But the time that I did spend out on the reservation was with my fathers and uncles and my family doing the normal stuff that we do out there, which is farming and ranching. So I grew up a part of a farming and ranching family. We were also hunters and fishermen and hikers. And so through those experiences, I learned a lot about being outdoors. Those experiences have all led to, in some way, my career as an archaeologist. That's ultimately what I chose to do with myself. And from then, it allowed me to pursue other careers, such as river guiding, hiking guide in the Grand Canyon. So I'm very fortunate to have these experiences in life that allow me to maintain a very personal connection to the outdoors. I feel very lucky to have this type of lifestyle. And so when Jack approached me about contributing a chapter to his book, I struggled a little bit because I wasn't sure, when I looked at the list of folks that were contributing, what I could bring to the table. And of course, being a part-time writer, you know, you hear the saying that, well, write what you know about. And so without really thinking about it too much, I started thinking about the experiences that I've had in life growing up to this point, that of being a part of the family that I'm from, being fortunate to come from a family that imparts some of the knowledge of being a Hopi person to those younger generations. And so I must say that, you know, what I talk about tonight isn't my knowledge, so to speak. It's the cumulative knowledge of many, many people that have come before me that I've been very fortunate to have in my life and work with. And so I definitely feel like I stand on the shoulders of giants out there who have been forthcoming with their knowledge, very sharing with it, and have allowed me to take from it what I can and apply it in my own life. And then from there, you get to this point in life where you start to realize that you're not so much a youngster anymore, but you're not the older person yet. And so I find myself in this middle area right now where I wonder what my role is sometimes. When the opportunity came to write the chapter for Jack's book, it helped put things in perspective for me in terms of tying together all these experiences, taking the knowledge that I had been given from older folks and seeing it as an opportunity, as an avenue to possibly use it to help teach some of the younger kids that are now growing up out at Hopi who may not have the opportunities to experience the things that I get to experience. Not everybody farms at Hopi. Not everybody's a hunter. Not everybody experiences the outdoors to the degree that my family has allowed me to. And I think that, you know, that's a revelation for a lot of the younger generations throughout the world, is that with technology, they've become more and more removed. I think we all have in some ways. It's not necessarily a bad thing. We just have to continue to find ways to maintain our physical, spiritual, mental connections with the place that we all started off from, which was the environment, the landscape. And so doing the chapter for Jack helped me realize that my role right now is really in continuing to listen to what the older folks have to tell me and contemplating what they're really trying to pass on to me. In my own way, through my own experiences, I'll be able to filter that and figure out how best to transmit that knowledge to my kids. I have two daughters, but I also have nieces and nephews and my community to think about. And so this whole experience has been a part of that learning process for me in terms of relating or reflecting back on all the things that I'm very fortunate to be a part of, which allow me to maintain some sense of traditional knowledge, but also to figure out how we as the younger folks can continue to move forward utilizing technology to help, you know, perpetuate our culture. So again, I feel very fortunate to be a part of it, and I thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Lyle. I want to mention something. It wasn't Jack's book, it was our book. All of us on the stage contributed chapters to a book called Thinking Like a Watershed, which is part of the title of this panel series. And the idea of that book was to try to understand exactly what it takes to see beyond just our human culture and see ourselves both as individuals and as part of a culture relative to our respective homelands. And that's what Thinking Like a Watershed begins to get into. Our third panelist this evening is another great old friend who has an understanding of the acequias of New Mexico that is very rare. He has actually got a new book coming out himself through UNM Press that he wrote about his understanding of the history of the acequias. And I'd like to welcome Esteban Arellano, the Acequero Maestro Superdude.
Thank you, Jack, and thanks everybody for coming. I'm like, I can't see. I hope there's more than two or three people over there. I don't know. I hope I'm not talking to myself. I come from Embudo, and for those of you that don't know what the word Embudo means, it's a funnel. Except that's the way the Embudo watershed is, like a funnel starts up in the Sangre de Cristo. The main mountain that provides water to us is called La Jicarita. It's above Picuris. And then on the south side is the boundaries is the Truchas Peak, the north part of the Truchas Peak, and also El Cañón de la Junta on the other side going north. And it all comes together kind of like a, well, like an embudo all the way where we live. It's called La Junta de los Ríos, or the juncture of the rivers, because Rio Embudo meets the Rio Grande there. And I'm part of the Embudo land grant, or La Merced del Embudo de Picuris. It used to be a 25,000-acre land grant. Now we only have about 800 acres because the rest of the land belongs now to the Bureau of Land Management and the State Land Office. But before, when people still owned all the land, people were able to survive off the land there for, well, starting in 1725 and before that, because the land where we live also used to be farmed by the people from Okeowinge and the people from Picuris. And we're right there along the Rio Grande as it goes to Taos by on Highway 68. Maybe you have heard of Dixon. You know, it's kind of confusing the way people, when they come in and establish a post office. That used to be the Plaza Vieja del Embudo de Nuestro Señor San Antonio. But in 1900, when we got a new post office, they named it after Collins Dixon, who was a deserter from the Civil War. So they asked him what would be a good name for the new post office, and he said Dixon, so we're stuck with Dixon. So now when you're trying to tell people where Embudo is, they say, oh, yeah, I know where Embudo is. But to them, Embudo is where the Embudo restaurant used to be, or right in the canyon before you get to Velarde. And Velarde also used to be called La Joya. But again, with the post office, it was changed to Velarde. So a lot of the villages up north lost their name because of the post office. Cieneguía now is called Pilar. And if you kept on going, you know, up in Santa Barbara, which is part of the Embudo, of the Embudo watershed, is now called Rodarte, but that used to be called Santa Barbara. So I don't have the time to go into all the detail as to all the place names there. But most of the place names there reflect the environment. Right within the Embudo land grant, we have the hamlets of Cañoncito, Montecito, Apodaca. Apodaca is a Basque name that means cranberry. Then we have El Bosque de Los Ángeles, and what we call Dixon today, which used to be the old plaza. Then we have Rinconada, La Bolsa, El Rincón, La Junta, La Ciénaga, and La Nasa. Those are all the little hamlets within the Embudo land grant. And then when you try to break it also, we have the commons. The commons at one time is where people used to graze their animals. Now we don't have the commons. Now they belong to the BLM. Now every time we step on what used to be our commons, now we have to ask permission for the BLM. Can we get some stones, rocks? Can we get some gravel? You know, before, even up to 1974, you could go in and get land from what used to be the commons. Not anymore. If they catch you there getting firewood or getting gravel, you might even lose your pickup, or you might even lose the tools that you have. So now we have to be a lot more careful. But, you know, now that everybody's talking about climate change, I think what we have to also look at is that, like Rina mentioned, we live in a high desert. Everybody's in a panic, you know, oh, it's so dry, a lot of people are saying we're not going to plant anything because it's going to be another disaster. Well, if you look back, in 1931 was a lot drier than what it is now, at least in the Rio Embudo, in the watershed there. In 1931, at this time, the Rio Embudo had only about 9 CFS. Now we have about 20. So as you look at, you know, the 1930s and 1950s were also very dry. It was only in the 80s and the 90s that we had more than enough water. And so everybody, especially a lot of the newcomers that moved into the Dixon and Budo area around that time, they're all in a panic. They said, no, you know, how can you people grow any food here? Well, people used to do it because of the acequias. The acequias is a very intricate system. We have 10 acequias that irrigate up the Rio Embudo. 5 on each side of the river. And during the summer, when it was very dry, the way people used to do it was to what they call the repartimiento. The repartimiento is a concept that goes back to the Middle East. It's about 4,000 years old, where people share the water. If there's only, let's say, for example, if there's only one glass of water and there's 4 of us, we would share it. We would take a drink or whatever we needed, you know, and we would share the water. Now, what we're having is that a lot of the people that are moving in, they're coming in from the East Coast where they used to have a lot of water, and they want to continue growing food the way they were growing in Minnesota or in Vermont or in New Jersey, wherever they came from. And this is very different in the West. So you had people knew how to survive by using a little bit of water. Some of the concepts that we have dealing with water, and the term acequia itself comes from Yemen. And it might have come also from research that I've done, probably from Ethiopia, across to Yemen, and up the Arabian Peninsula through Morocco to the Iberian Peninsula, and eventually to Mexico, and up the Camino Real to New Mexico. My dad always, when he was irrigating, he said he had to irrigate using what he called a filito de agua, or a trickle of land, of water. And that's the best way to irrigate when you're irrigating your garden. If you're in a hurry and you irrigate with a lot of water, what that's going to do is that you're going to compact the soil. And if you're going to compact the soil is going to be hard and the plants are not going to grow. So you have an hilito de agua, which is also an Arab concept, and you use it very sparingly, the water, until it gets to the end. And what that does is that the water really penetrates down into the roots and into the aquifer. Now what we're having is a conflict with some of the people that are coming in with drip irrigation. I don't have nothing against drip irrigation, but what they want is that they want to use the water every day. And when you're dividing the water through the repartimiento, you might get the water only once a week. And it depends on how much land you have. You might have it for 1 hour, you might have it for 2 hours, or if you have maybe 10 acres, you might have it for half a day. So it all depends. It's all based on the amount of land that you have. The water in the river was also divided among the acequias. The 4 upper acequias would get the water for 3 days. The 4 lower acequias would get it for 4 days. Back in 2000, that it was so as dry as it's now, or probably even a little bit drier, what we had to do is that we had to carry the water only on one side of the river, and then when those finished irrigating on one side, we would move to the other side. So the cycle, instead of being 7 days, was 11 days. And people survived. The only difference between then and now is that the acequias were maintained at that point. Now we're not maintaining the acequias. Now, if you go through the village, you wouldn't even know where the acequias are, because they're full of Russian olives, Siberian elms, and we're not taking care of the invasive species. So we have to take better care. There's enough water, and also we have to have, like my mom used to say, you have to have faith. If you don't have faith that there's a God or there's a higher being than who we are, then don't plant anything. But if you really have faith, God will provide, you know. There's going to be water. There's going to be... Last year, everybody was crying. Then we had so much rain in September that we didn't know what to do with it. So I want to thank all of you for your time to come and listen to us. And hopefully, if you're ever in Embudo, stop by so you can see the acequias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Esteban has brought up a term that I want to ask us all to address here, and that's the term, the commons. Those of you who are here, the last panel that we had, we addressed the whole notion of the tragedy of the commons. Garrett Hardin wrote an essay about the tragedy of the commons, where everybody, the population kept growing and growing and growing, and everybody kept putting more and more cattle into the common pasture land until everybody knew that if they put any more cattle in there, the ecosystem itself would crash. And the tragedy was that everybody knew it, and they did it anyway. Well, this is something we're really hoping to avoid. It's been a couple of years now, but I was visiting Rena up at the Santa Clara Pueblo, and I was asking Rena if she could give me her impression of what the commons is. And she gave me a dynamite answer, and I hope you can remember it today.
I don't know, Jack, but I can tell you what I think it is today. you know, the whole Pueblo world is based on the commons. There's the plaza area and the houses that are interconnected around it, but that's only a tiny bit of the story. What we have then are the small hills around, and then from there are the large mountains. It's again back to what that relationship is between people who live in a human common area. We shared everything within that plaza area. The food was brought there, wood was brought there, that was shared among all the people who lived there. And then the fields, of course, out surrounding the physical human space. But very, very important also were those hills where the herbs were, and where the rabbits were, and where the coyotes were. That all was part of who we were as people. But but beyond that were also the mountains from where the clouds came. And of course the clouds bringing the rain, the snow, the hail, whatever came out of it. It was a whole cycle of events that went on within our common world. And you know, we're all, the Pueblos are very strange because here's one Pueblo here, Santa Clara here, 3 miles away is San Ildefonso. They're the center of the world. They have their whole world, their whole common system, set of relationships, everything being shared, and this going on there in a well-defined world, the Sandias out there, the Haymas out there, containing us very clearly and watching for the clouds coming in from there, doing our dances, talking to the clouds because we can talk to the clouds because they're part of our commons. We, you know, like a woman from San Felipe said some time ago when we were talking with them about water, is that they're, you know, we're 99% water as human beings, and so we can talk to water, we can talk to the clouds, they're all part of our language. What is that about? Okay, so here sits San Clara, 3 miles away is San Ildefonso, exactly the same thing going on, our boundaries overlapping, no problem. It's because there's a sense of, no, that's the way you describe your world. We respect your sense of the world, your center of your community, and you do ours, and we're all okay. It's a sense of respecting other people's boundaries as well in the commons. I don't know if that's what you
have. That was beautiful. Yeah. It's always beautiful. How about you, Lyle? Could you talk about the Hopi sense of the commons or your interpretation of it that you can talk about?
Well, I think Rena kind of synthesized the Pueblo worldview very well there. You know, even though Hopi is way over there to the west, we still are a part of this larger pan-Pueblo culture that has existed here for thousands of years. Like she said, it's about the interconnectedness of not just us as human beings interacting with one another, other clans, other villages. Out at Hopi, we have 3 mesas with 13 villages spread out over a 50-mile area. But it's also our connections and understandings of the resources out there, and maybe that's not the right term for it, but the animals, the vegetation, the greater forces out there that we feel we have the opportunity to interact with. And so, like Rena said, you know, it's about those things out there, and I'm struggling for a right word to categorize him, but all of those forces that inhabit our world, and maybe even those metaphysical forces that we don't necessarily have a physical, tangible touch on, but we know they're there, the spiritual side of things that each and every one of us has within us to engage in, understanding that that is a part of the shared energy that we as people have an influence on. So out at Hopi, you know, we understand that, yes, we are autonomous villages. We have the ability to govern ourselves in a traditional manner, and we do have the more Western style of Hopi tribal government in place. But also understanding that our actions, what we do in our village, does have an impact to our neighbors next door. And so there's a common area between the villages, between the mesas that we share, you know, the things that we utilize there, the herbs, the animals, even when it comes down to our cornfields, you know, we're out there helping our clan relatives or related clans, helping do their things in their cornfields, and vice versa, they come and help us. And so it's more than just a physical landscape kind of idea. I think it stretches into the energies that you put forth physically, but more importantly, the energies you put out physically as a group, collectively, so that, you know, you help to propagate or facilitate a greater good in for the community. And it's easier said than done in many ways. Coming together as human beings sometimes creates conflict, and so you have to work through those conflicts to figure out the common good. We hear that saying a lot. What does it really mean? And in Hopi, a lot of it is contained within the religion, which, you know, I'm not going to go into very much here, but a lot of the basic foundations of how we view each other as related to one another as human beings, but also to the rest of the world we inhabit, is contained within those teachings, you know, that happen as part of the ceremonial religious cycle. Deep philosophical things, but that have their manifestation in our actions and in our thoughts and in our prayers. And so the commons, to me, when I think about it, is more than just our physical, tangible form as human beings, but what we put forth in our prayers.
To me, not being born into any of the indigenous families or communities that occur in New Mexico, having been born in West Virginia, actually. And I think that my placenta was tossed in the Ohio River, and I suspect I've been catfish food now for 77 and a half years. But I also think, in large measure, that's one reason I like to go river running. But the flow of nature, to me, seems to be part of this. Is that, would anybody interpret that way, that the flow of nature is actually fundamental? How about you, yeah. Esteban?
Well, I think for us, you know, when you're talking about the commons, again, you know, we start up with the high sierras, and then we come down to the mountains, and of course the grazing lands, and then before the houses were all used to be built above the acequia, in what were called solares, and the acequia was kind of like a belt, you know, that divided the private lands or the irrigated fields from what were the commons. But also part of the commons were the fruits that grow there, the herbs, the firewood, the vigas, the latias, everything there was common to everybody. And also before, people used to help each other out a lot, not the way it is now. The acequias themselves were, though they were not part of the commons, everything was done in common. even afterwards when you picked up the harvest, we had a concept that's called el rastrojo. Then you would let all the livestock in the rastrojo. And that was a way of also spreading the manure as the animals went from one field to the next, to the next, to the next. Instead of now everybody with their pickup and their fences. There were no fences when I was still growing up. I don't remember there being fences, you know. Or we still could go to any place. Now you can't go anywhere because there's always keep out, no trespassing, keep out, no trespassing. So we ourselves made ourselves prisoners in our own land. Instead of saying, no, everything is coming to everybody. The food was the same thing. We have a concept in Spanish that's called el convite, or like from convivian. So when people did something, especially for the holidays, they would make enough to share with all the neighbors. Now, whatever we cook, it's only for ourselves, you know. And before, I think there was no greed like there is today. Everybody belonged to everybody. And like they used to say, if your nose was running, there was always somebody there with a handkerchief to clean your nose when you were a little kid. Todos te limpiaban el moco.
Beautiful.
That's not common anymore, you know. Everybody's in their own house. Everybody's afraid to go out. Even the dogs, now you have to keep them tied up. If you have any type of animals, the same thing. Before, everything was loose and everything. Everybody knew who the animals belonged to. Everybody knew who the kids belonged to. And that's one of the things that I miss the most about when I was growing up. When I was growing up, you know, the fields, the rivers, everything belonged to the whole community. It wasn't mine. Now everything is mine or belongs to her or to you or to somebody else. And that's what I think we have to get back if we're going to be talking about the commons. I think a tragedy of the commons is that we have lost what the concept is. We don't know what the concept is of the commons. Commons implies that it belongs to everybody, every member of the community.
You know, you had something you wanted to say, Rena.
You were talking about wanting to talk about the flow, you know, the flow of nature, as it were. Reminds me of the ex-governor of Cochiti talking about Cochiti Lake and the dam that was constructed there, and how the Cochiti people feel that it's like putting a tourniquet on yourself because the flow of the river is like the flow within your body. There's a flow of water and an energy that goes with that, as well as with the air that you breathe. You know, and we're always trying to stop it somehow or the other. But that the flow that I think the incredible thing is that the flow that happens just naturally in the world, the clouds that bring the moisture, and then the moisture that sinks in, and the springs that come up, and the waters that flow from there, and then that creates more moisture, goes back in, and that's a remarkable thing in this place, that any place on earth. And I think we forget to breathe that in. And so much of my understanding of Pueblo is about breathing in and letting the flow happen. Even the air that we take in, you know, the water, that we can't live without water. We can't live without air. And so that actually allows us to move, to flow. Our bodies are very much like nature itself.
One of the things that I really wanted to see if we had any thoughts about, because we know we're living in a pretty messed up world right now. We have whole systems of cultural attitudes which are totally out of sync with the flow of nature. And what I'd like to ask anybody who has anything they want to say is, what could be contributed from the indigenous perspectives that come from having live within communities that are truly conscious of the flow of nature through their communities. Who would like to address that one? What can be offered to culture at large right now to help heal a very, very fragile world?
Well, I think one of the things that that I think we have in terms of who we are up in northern New Mexico is that we know that the land has a certain wisdom. In Spanish, we call it el juicio de la tierra, the wisdom of the land. But by the same token, water has a certain knowledge, the knowledge of water. And one thing that I think a lot of times we forget is that water also has a memory. Because we know where water goes, you know, we can follow it, and we know where it's going to go. And even like in some of the acequias, it seems like it's flowing up instead of, but it's a kind of an optical illusion that when we see it. So I think that if we know that there's a certain inherent knowledge in water and in land, then we're going to be able to take better care of the land. That's why people a lot of times would do a lot of terraces to be able to retain the moisture from the little rainwater that we get. One of the worst things that happened really in northern New Mexico at one, I think, were the tractors. Because the tractors were too big for the area for the small plots that we have. So a lot of these terraces that used to exist in all the villages were torn down by the tractors, because the tractors were so big they could not just turn around. It was very different when you used horses for plowing. But I think that's what I see, you know, that we forget that water has a memory. Land has a certain inherent wisdom also. And for me, that's what, you know, in what we call that, I guess, is the concept of querencia. Querencia comes from the love of place. And for us, I think that's a certain land ethic, kind of different from Aldo Leopold's land ethic, but that's our land ethic. It's based right there where we are. And even the plants, the same thing. One of the plants that came to northern New Mexico, and it doesn't make much sense until you start looking at it, are the lilac plants. What's the value of the lilac plants? Well, people planted the lilac plants, the bushes, because the lilacs were site-specific. When they start to leaf out in the spring, in the spring, that means that it's time to start your spring garden. When the flowers fall off, which is about 6-7 weeks afterwards, that's time to spring to start your fall garden. And they're all very specific. The lilacs in the Middle Rio Grande are going to be different from the lilacs in Española, from the lilacs in Embudo, from the lilacs in Taos. But those were plants, that's the reason that they were brought over, so that you could tell the farmers also about when to plant. And that's a lot of the memory that's being lost, and we have to recapture that memory again.
That's something I want to bring up right now, because that, not long ago, I was sitting there thinking about some of this stuff, and I got to thinking that consciousness itself is a commons. And what you're talking about, Esteban, is a commons of human consciousness that understands these different relationships and what you've talked to. And how can anybody relate to that idea? Consciousness itself is a commons. I think of it as something that is really a fragile thing. And we have to be really careful what we put into it and really careful what we take out of it. But does that ring a bell with anybody?
Well, we have a word in Tewa, which is the language of northern Pueblos. Some of them, Karis is there also, but Tewa. As Sehkane, which is meaning, you know, everything, take every step with respect and with consideration. Care and respect and consideration is what it comes out to. And I think that's part of, that's all about consciousness. Be constantly aware of where you're stepping and who is around and what is around. Know your context. Be aware of where you are and respect it.
When we think about, well, we look at, say, New Mexico, it now has a population of just over 2 million. I don't know what the population of Arizona, as it's now known, is, but it's, Craig Newbill told me that the last 2 years, the population of New Mexico has diminished by about 20,000 people a year, which is really interesting. We think about global warming and climate instability, and which is largely brought to us by the presence of humanity. One of the things that I think I mentioned this last time, but in my own lifetime, the human population of this planet has tripled, better than tripled. And that's an amazing thought. When I was born, it was just over 2 billion. And now it's over 7 billion. And so we have this growing human population in a world of diminishing resources. And to me, we can create laws and do this and that and the other thing. One of the things that I think is a great error is how so much of human legislation is in direct violation of natural law. And that's one of the things that I think that we really have to contend with. But what I'm really hoping, in my experience, just being out in it and getting to hang out with you guys and so many other really wonderful folks, is that there's a perspective that exists within the context of people who live in indigenous communities, who were born into indigenous communities, that still abide by the flow of nature, at least on some fundamental level. Before we close, I want to mention something. About 12 years ago, I had the opportunity to interview a man by the name of Luna Leopold. He was a son of Aldo Leopold. And he was one of the great hydrographers for both the Colorado River system and also the Rio Grande. But one of the things that he pointed out to me was that Lake Mead and Lake Powell, between them, these two great reservoirs on the Colorado River, evaporate about one-tenth of the flow of the Colorado River. And so thinking about dams and backing up water, sure, it may look like we're saving water, but we have to very carefully think this out, because if it's evaporating at such an enormous rate, as happens when you live in a desert, you know, we really have to be conscious. It's that one of the great gifts of life is consciousness. And boy, we better use it as best we possibly can. I think that that may be our highest calling, actually, is to become as conscious as we can. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming tonight. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that was Jack Loeffler, Rena Swensel, Lyle Belenqua, and Esteban Arellano in the second of a series of 5 panel discussions on water, culture, and climate change in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, recorded at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. We will be airing the rest of the series each Monday for the next 3 weeks. The third panel will focus on rural perspectives and will include rancher Sid Goodlow from near El Capitan, New Mexico, author and garlic farmer Stan Crawford from Dixon, and outfitter and director of Rio Grande Restoration, Steve Harris from Pilar, New Mexico. The panels are funded and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and The Lore of the Land. They are produced and moderated by oral historian and author Jack Loeffler.